G'day there, Tom Uren here, and today the Gruck and I are going to talk about how big cyber organizations can appear to be all-powerful, but are in fact constrained in all sorts of different ways. Before that, I'd just like to thank our founding corporate sponsors Proofpoint and the cyber initiative at the Hewlett Foundation. G'day, Gruck.
Hi, Tom. Hi, everyone.
My received impression of what people think of organizations, particularly the big Western ones, is that they can just do anything, anywhere, anytime. And that if NSA wants to listen to you, they can do that anywhere in the world. And at least partially, I think that this arises from popular culture and Hollywood movies. And just as an aside, the only movie I've seen which actually captured what I used to do is, in fact, Transformers. In Transformers, there's an Australian signals analyst who travels to NSA and is involved at least in part. But anyway, that's an aside. I think the point there is that people think some of these big organizations can do anything, anytime, anywhere. But in fact, they're actually really constrained. But you were saying that perhaps we should start by looking at a small organization.
Yeah, so I think part of the misconception is that we look at software a lot of the time. It scales infinitely in a way. If you work in InfoSec, there's a reasonable chance that you have worked or do work with a pen testing agency of some sort, and you know that there's a limit to how much can be done. Like, even if you have all of the scanning tools and all of the whatevers, you know, you can only automate so far, and you are limited by the bodies that you have. There is a capacity that you can function at, and it's sort of worth remembering that that holds true for the big agencies as well.
Yeah, so I guess in this example, you're saying that what those agencies do is like pen testing, and pen testing requires a lot of, I don't know, stopping and thinking about what to do next.
Yeah, and there's other things as well. Like, when you talk to pen testers, like, the stuff that they're focused on is gaining access. And that's sort of like, once you've gained access, game over, you tag something or flag something and you write your report and you're done. Whereas in real operations, gaining access is step zero. Like, now that you've gained access, let's burrow our way in, find the thing that we're tasked with finding, begin collecting it, exfiltrate it, get it to the people who are going to do processing and then analysis and then producing a product and giving it on.
And do all that without getting caught.
And then I want to bring up the Belarus cyber partisans because I love them.
Yeah. So just to jump in there, that was one of the first discussions that you and I had. So if you've just joined this podcast recently, dive back into the history.
So I think the amazing thing with the Belarus cyber partisans is, like, they're very, like, it's a large group overall, but they're very small in terms of the actual operators. It's, you know, five people, seven people, something like that. The people who are actually doing the cyber stuff. But amazing as they are in Belarus, I don't think they could do the same thing in, let's say, Australia or China or Vietnam or other places that an actual agency is expected to operate, where you, like, if you're an agency, you have to operate in China and Iran, and you have to operate in other areas in the Middle East, and you probably need to operate in Eastern Europe.
Right. So to me, that seems like you're saying that there are constraints based on local knowledge, perhaps. So one thing that occurs to me is the language.
Exactly.
And so each time you have a target that speaks a different language, you need some sort of linguistic support. And probably, I'm going to guess that linguists aren't that common, so that's going to be some capacity constraint to actually understand that. Were you talking about something else in addition to that?
I was focusing sort of not just on the language, but the amount of effort that goes into going after a target. Language is obviously a big part of it. If you don't speak the language, it's incredibly difficult. I remember way back in the dawn of time when I used to do pen tests, I got some that were in languages I didn't speak, and it was incredibly difficult just because if it's in English, I can glance at a page, you know, a web page, I have an idea what it's doing, I know which things I can click, you know, and where they should take me. Like, I've got a sort of idea of what's going on. In a foreign language, I got nothing. It doesn't make any sense. I don't know what's the about page, yeah. What's the context.
Yep.
But it's also sort of, let's say, like, target verticals.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Right, so like an ISP, for example, is going to have its own sort of jargon.
Oh, right. So where I thought you were going to go with that was that the Belarus cyber partisans would know the government there and would actually know what they want to... What are we after? What do we want to achieve? Where do we go to get that?
That's sort of one thing I was getting at, but I sort of want to build on that with, as we were talking about with language, where there's these target verticals, right? And I think government is one as well. You know, like if you're going after the State Department, you probably have expectations of what you're looking for, but you're going to have to know like diplomatese. You're going to have to know sort of how it is structured, that, you know, if you're interested in how treaties are proposed and debated internally before they get pushed out, there's going to be a department that does that. And so finding that department is going to take a level of technical expertise that isn't technical in the way that we usually think about it. It's government fluency.
Yeah, so I just wonder if, say, let's take the State Department, because we're talking about that, and you get onto their email system, which is, I presume, where you want to be. Do you really need to understand the org structure to then grep through emails or filter by, from, or to? How important do you think that is?
I think that depends on the targeting. Because I'm an outsider, I don't know the sort of tasking that actually comes down. So I'm approaching this as just a red teamer from the outside. The way I would see it showing up is someone says, we are interested in the treaty development process and what they're thinking for an oil field just offshore.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so what I'm thinking then is that I was kind of stuck in the mindset of the cyber partisans, where you've got a really small number of people. But in that case, the expertise actually would come outside of the, air quotes, pen tester group.
Right.
And so they would get tasking that says, when you get onto the email...
Right, you're looking for Joe
Blogs. You search for these people, but you know that because you've got the bureaucratic background and understanding to be tasked with that. So I guess that means my question was not nonsensical, but it was asking that question of the wrong people.
Right. And one of the things I want to bring up when we're talking about capacity is that the sort of roles that people have in a SIGINT cyber group, that's its own sort of capacity. So the people who get access are not necessarily the same people who maintain the infrastructure that you use when you're getting access, or who develop the exploits, or who access the implants and collect the data from the last month that pull in the take. Those can be different roles. And so in theory, if you have like a large access group that you can just shift around as you need them, and then another team of operators that you can shift in afterwards and be like, okay, your job is just to click collect on, you know, the third of every month. You hit this button and then you take the RAR file and you put it over there. That sort of thing happens as well. Like that sort of specialization. And that can be its own set of constraints, where you've got like 1,000 people, but only so many of them can do access. And so when you need to shift them around, you have to take them from somewhere else. Even when you could say like NSA has got like 1,000, 5,000 people doing cyber, 10,000 people doing cyber, they're not like a generic cyber person that you have, right? They will have, you know, maybe they're, and they speak Persian and they do Windows and they're really good at gaining access. So you kind of, that's where they tend to go, is on the Iranian ops when you have to break in somewhere, and then they help developing Windows exploits or whatever. But it doesn't mean that you've got like this one generic person that you can now shift over to China Solaris ops.
Yeah. And you know, I have always thought that there's a kind of tip of the spear aspect to this, and that for these kinds of organizations to be really effective, they need to bring together all sorts of people doing all sorts of things. And when it comes to the hardest, most difficult, most amazing operations, there's actually very, very few people who are of the right caliber, have the right skills, and can also work together to achieve something. And so that really limits capacity for those kinds of organizations to do the most cutting edge things.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess where that hits Hollywood is that people think that the cutting edge things are routine.
Right.
Whereas, in fact, they're cutting edge.
Yeah, it's with the, like, you can do something amazing. It doesn't mean that everything you do is amazing.
Yes. Yeah, and I suppose the flip side to that is that these organizations also have a lot of priorities that they want to satisfy. And so they can't satisfy every really difficult priority. They've got to pick and choose.
No,
I have relatives who worry about being surveilled by NSA. And it's like, my God, they've just got really a lot better things to do.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me, one of the things I wanted to point out about these sort of hacktivist operations in Russia, where people sort of think that the Ukrainian secret services are behind it. The Ukrainian secret services are fighting a war. If there is an operation that is non-essential, it wasn't them.
Yep.
Every single free person that they have is busy doing things that are directly war-related. And they're also trying to do two things at the same time sort of stuff. Like, they are overflowing with tasks. They do not have time to go and scan for IP cameras that also have a speaker that they can then play the national anthem over. That's not going to be a priority over finding out production schedules for smart munitions.
Yeah. What I've picked out so far is we've got different types of constraints, right? We've got skills constraints. Like, you've only got so many top-notch skills for every different mission you want. You've got language constraints. You've got constraints around understanding targets.
Mm-hmm.
What are we trying to get out of them? Who are we even looking at?
Where would we find what we're looking for, I think, is one of the...
Yeah, and I would describe all of those as human factors where it's it's people actually knowing stuff that you need to get from A to B. So there's this layer of, at least in theory, you could have computers sitting everywhere in the world, I don't know, on internet cables or something like that, just sucking up everything. But that, in a way, gets you a lot of data. It doesn't help you with any of those human factors.
Yeah, and I think one of the things I want to, just while we're on the topic, huge difference between information and intelligence. And it's the processing of information that turns it into intelligence. Like, it has to be analyzed, combined with other stuff, and then put together. And the thing of, like, sucking in just huge amounts of data is it makes it harder to find that intelligence that you're looking for. Just having more data doesn't necessarily make you have more intelligence.
Right, yep.
Right, it can actually make it a lot harder because now instead of trawling through a gigabyte of emails, you have to trawl through 60 terabytes of data to find the emails.
So I think, like, we've kind of looked at it through the lens of these different features, which are constraints. But I don't know that I've really hit on the reason that NSA just still isn't, well, I mean, it is a behemoth, and Russia's got very large organizations as well. I just don't know them as well. And so the Belarusian cyber partisans can do so well with a small group. Why aren't these very much larger groups doing just however many times better?
Right.
Because I think that that's true. I think that they don't do X times better.
They're not 1,000 times better than Belarus cyber partisans, even though they have 1,000 times more people.
Yeah.
What we're saying. Yeah.
And so one possibility is that you get bigger and you just get more bureaucracy. Necessary evils?
Not in a good way.
Compliance, security, human resources,
I think
cleaners.
Yeah, so I think one of the things we're talking around a lot is just how many different types of constraints exist when you get into it. There are constraints created by the target, such as the language or the type of target it is, you know, government agency, telco, whatever. There are constraints in terms of the amount of attention that an agency is going to place on a particular operation. And I think we're talking about if it's a fire that's being put out right now, that gets a lot of attention, whereas if this is a thing in 6 months that might be nice to know, that probably doesn't get as much resources available. So that's a sort of capacity problem in terms of I don't know if it's organizational attention, whatever it's called, but that's a sort of capacity problem. And then there's sort of these more hard limits of just the technology that you have available and the manpower that you have available, and then the skilled manpower as well. So yeah, I think a perfect example of this is actually the Lockheed hack that the Chinese did a little over 10 years ago now, where basically in order to get in, first they had to get into RSA, but RSA was running a software defense package that had to be broken into first. So they broke into that, they were able to compromise the protection that that gave, then they got into RSA and were able to get the seeds of the keys, and then they got into Lockheed and were able to get what they actually wanted. And the thing is, the team that did that, right, like let's just call that the A team, right? That's not the same team that they had running Poison Ivy and, you know, chatting on Facebook through compromised hosts.
Yep.
Those are different groups of people. And so they probably don't have that many A teams who can do that sort of work. If they're going to task that
sort
of...
Yeah, I think that's right, because I think it's just like sports, right? There's only one Usain Bolt at any one time.
Mm-hmm.
And even he doesn't turn up that often, or runners of that caliber, right? So quite a few times when I used to work there, there'd be discussions about capabilities that we wanted to run. And often this discussion would happen where it'd be, well, you know, I'm sure our A-team could defeat the security protections, which probably means that their A-team could, and therefore those security protections aren't good enough. Which always struck me as quite frustrating, because of course, if you're going up against the best in the world, that's like a tremendously difficult task.
Right.
But the things we were trying to protect weren't that important, to be honest.
Yeah, it sounds to me a little bit like we've put PFC nobody with, he just came out of boot camp 6 months ago and he's on guard duty. But if anyone really wanted to break into this camp and, you know, they were the Navy SEALs, PFC nobody doesn't stand a chance. So you know what?
Exactly.
Let's not even bother putting PFC nobody on gate duty, because if the SEALs showed up, he would be screwed. So,
well, I guess in the story I'm telling, you don't even build the camp because PFC nobody can't protect it. Whereas the story is that the SEALs just don't care because it's not that important.
It's too far away from water and they would dry out before they get there, you know.
Well, it was just they had better things to do. So to me, there's this sort of duality of being very capable but having limited ability to do the most amazing things. So to me, that's the heart of the reason I think these organizations are constrained.
Right. And I mean, I think sports is a good one. It's like you have your Olympic team. Your Olympic team is not playing weekend football down, you know, at the village green. Your absolute top end can't be everywhere. And so...
Yeah, yeah. And what amazes me is, it, like, you look at sports and you look at a bell curve and just how long the tails are. And that's, I think, where those organizations are operating at. Like, you get people on the tails who are just way better than everyone else on the entire planet.
Absolutely,
like,
yeah.
Like, not top 10%. It's like... top in the world.
Yeah, like there's just every now and then there's some hackers that you meet and they're not humans.
Mm.
Right? Like their skill level is just, it's beyond. And yeah, like that's absolutely amazing. And then you think, wow, you know, if just one of these guys is working for the right team, that team is going to be amazing. And that's true, but like even though I think...
But there is only one of those guys.
Exactly, right? So, you know, like, yeah, this guy's amazing. He can do Windows, he can do Linux, he can do Solaris, he does, I don't know, like NetBSD. It's like, but he doesn't do them all at the same time. I think some of the stuff that we've talked about that's sort of useful for people to keep in mind is that a lot of the capacity that exists is also, it's constrained. So... NSA has a huge amount of capacity, but they also have a huge amount of priorities.
Yeah.
And that poses constraints in all sorts of ways, from just the number of people they have available to the managers that can focus on multiple things at different times and be like, you know, this is a priority now and this can wait or whatever. I think that's worth keeping in mind. And the other thing that I think we sort of wanted to get across is that these agencies don't do a lot of just because operations. Like, they're not doing a lot of fun stuff just because it's fun. Right, like they don't.
I'm just laughing because I've never heard of anyone doing anything because it's fun.
Right, it's just like that's not a thing. Like they don't go, you know, it'd be great. I bet Tom's got some relatives. Let's find out what they're talking about. I bet that's interesting. You know, let's go peer through their webcam. Like, they don't have time for that.
Ironically, they don't have time for that, but they've got time to make sure that that doesn't happen. And like that's a kind of serious point about the license to operate, I guess, in a democracy. Mm-hmm. Like, you need to show that you're
proportional,
behaving responsibly, and there is auditing and stuff like that. And that is what I would call a strategic mission. Like, you would actually be faster not to audit anything, just let people go hell for leather. But that would be a very short-term win, because eventually people would figure out you're being misused, and then therefore you would get your ability to operate would be constrained. I suppose the other thing is that the way that you have priorities constrains what you can actually do, in that you shape your organization around them.
Right.
And so the old trope that NSA can spy on you anywhere. Well, no, because NSA has got priorities. It tries to spy on people in particular places at particular times because it's got, it's got intelligence priorities, right? And those priorities, it doesn't make them up itself. They come from elsewhere in the US government. Those priorities, by and large, are pretty stable over time. Occasionally, they'll change hugely, like after September 11.
Right. I was going to bring that up like when the counterterrorism thing came up, that was a huge priority shift. But then once it had happened, it stuck around for 20 years.
Yeah, exactly. But I guess that's an example of their mission had been optimized for something else. It wasn't optimized for extremist terrorism. And it took time to reshape what they were doing. And I think a lot of time, that's one of those constraints. When you build an organization, like, not only the people, but also the equipment you've got, where you are, what you're doing, they're all shaped around those missions. And when those missions change, it takes time to change.
Yeah, there's a lot of infrastructure, not just in terms of hardware, but like the people and the processes. Even the paperwork forms that you have are going to be sort of Cold War, right? Like, and then East Germany vanishes, right? And so those forms stop being useful and you have to retool. But then also, like, when the unification happens, the East Germans cease to be the enemy.
Yeah. One of the interesting things about the change to focusing on terrorists, and it clearly wasn't focusing exclusively on terrorists, you've still got governments in the world, but they're a very different target set than governments. Like, governments have offices and buildings and bureaucracies and hierarchies, and that's a very comfortable place for a government bureaucracy to be operating.
Yeah, it's mirror imaging in a sort of way. So it's the sort of thing of like, all those jokes about like the Al-Qaeda number three. The thing is, like, Al-Qaeda doesn't have a number three. So they don't, those are not, like, it's not structured in a way where there's positions like that. And it was very confusing to move from, you know, this is how it's built, to like, it's not like that anymore.
So I think there's this conception that if you've got the best hackers, you're the best at producing intelligence, or you're the best intelligence agency or whatever. But I think that there's really a lot of human factors that go into it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think as, you know, technical cyber people, we get a little bit confused in this stuff. We get really into the technology because it's great and it's exciting, but it's very limited. And this is why I got into OPSEC, was this realization that technology is not the whole thing. So for me, getting into OPSEC was this realization that security was not necessarily about having the best encryption. It was about not telling everyone what you were doing. Having it encrypted is great, but if you just blurt it out, then it doesn't do you any good. And I think there's an aspect of that with espionage in general, is that a lot of the time, the technology stuff, like the hacking, whatever, is just putting you in a position where your human skills can come out. So
yep.
You can have someone who develops iOS exploits for you. And you maybe you only need like one really good guy to get one exploit that works. And now you can hack every iOS device everywhere. But if you do that, you still can't process them all. You don't have the capacity to sort of do the analysis, that sort of that other part of understanding the person. Yeah.
You can hack all the things, but you can't produce intelligence on all the things.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think the idea of hacking something is not the same as producing intelligence.
It's the means to the end.
And
the constraints are maybe not even the hacking in the first place. Or hacking is only one of the constraints, perhaps.
Yes, yeah, I think absolutely that. It's that, you know, there's things about like deciding what to hack, you know, being able to hack it, et cetera, et cetera. But once you do, you still need all of these other things to actually do something useful with it. And yeah, people lose sight of that. And we've talked a bunch about various limitations on the capacity to hack. But I think sort of more importantly is understanding that hacking is, contextually, hacking is part of the process that they're doing. It's not the end goal. It's not the thing that they're trying to achieve. That's just the way that what they're trying to achieve gets done.
Yes, I think we did talk about the intelligence cycle once, and we made the point that the access is just one slice of that cycle.
Yeah, and people who get worried about like, oh, they can hack every iOS phone or every iOS device are missing that the hacking is not their goal. Like, they don't want to just hack every device. They want to be able to hack every device in case they need to hack a specific device.
Yep. Well, thanks a lot, Grok.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, man.